Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about two men who flew across an entire ocean before most of the world believed it could be done. And I'll bet you a cup of hangar coffee that if I stopped 10 pilots on the ramp today and asked who was first to fly nonstop across the Atlantic, 9 of them would say Lindbergh. They'd be wrong. Charles Lindbergh was a fine airman, and I'll not say a word against him, but when the Spirit of St. Louis touched down in Paris, that was 1927. The Atlantic had already been conquered nonstop, wheels up in one place and wheels down in another 8 years before that, 1919. By two Englishmen in a converted bomber, held together with wood, wire, and a stubbornness you could not buy at any price. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. Today we go back to the very edge of what an airplane could do and we meet John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every coin tells a story. I like that because this whole show is about stories and about the folks who earned the right to tell them. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene for you. It's the spring of 1919. The Great War has been over for just a few months. The world is exhausted, grieving, and somehow at the same time, electric with what airplanes had suddenly become. 4 years of war had dragged aviation out of the county fair and turned it into a serious machine, engines that actually ran, airframes that could carry a real load, and thousands of young men who had learned to fly the hard way, over the trenches, and were now home with nothing to point all that nerve at. And there was a prize sitting on the table. A London newspaper, the Daily Mail, had offered £10,000 to the first crew to fly across the Atlantic nonstop. From anywhere in North America to anywhere in the British Isles, in under 72 hours, £10,000 in 1919 was a fortune. More than that, it was glory, and glory, back when the sky was still mostly empty, was worth even more than the money. So the teams gathered in Newfoundland. That was the jumping-off point, the far eastern tip of North America, closest to Europe, all rock and fog and mud. Several crews were out there that spring, all of them eyeing the same stretch of gray water. Some tried and ditched in the sea. Some never got the chance to try at all. Enter our two men. John Alcock was the pilot, a Manchester lad, round-faced and cheerful, a natural stick-and-rudder man, who had flown bombers in the war and spent time as a prisoner after being shot down over Turkey. Flying was simply what he was for. You've met the type. Some people are pilots the way other people are left-handed. It isn't a decision, it's just how they came out of the box. Arthur Witten Brown was the navigator, and he was a very different animal. Quieter, more serious. He'd been an engineer before the war. He'd been shot down himself. He carried a bad leg from a crash and walked with a cane the rest of his life. But Brown could do the thing that mattered most on a flight like this. Brown could find his way across an ocean with a compass, a watch, and the stars. And that, right there, is the part I want you to hold on to. Because in 1919, there were no radio beacons out over the Atlantic. No controllers, no moving map, nobody on the ground who could tell you where you were. Once you left the coast of Newfoundland, you were on your own in the most complete sense of that word. Your position was whatever the navigator said it was. If he was wrong, you flew until the fuel ran out and the ocean took you. Their airplane was a Vickers, Vimy. Now the Vimy was built to be a heavy bomber, designed to carry bombs to Germany. The war ended before it saw much of that work. So here was this big, honest, twin-engine biplane looking for a purpose. Two Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, 360 horsepower apiece, a wingspan of more than 60 feet, fabric over a wooden frame, and an open cockpit. Open, no canopy, no heater, no windshield to speak of. Just you, side by side with the other fellow, stuck out in the weather with the whole North Atlantic screaming past your goggles. They stripped out the bomb gear and filled the airplane with fuel instead, extra tanks everywhere. When she was loaded, she weighed something like 6 tons, and every ounce of that had to stagger off a rough field carved out of a Newfoundland hillside. They named the field Lester's Field. It was short, it sloped, and there were stone walls and a stand of trees waiting at the far end for anybody who couldn't get the wheels up in time. Now here's where it gets interesting. They launched on the afternoon of June the 14th, 1919. And the takeoff alone nearly killed them. That heavy Vimy clawed off the grass so slowly, so reluctantly, that men who were watching swore she'd never make it over the trees. She staggered into the air with feet to spare, wallowing, the two eagles howling at full song, and then she was out over the water and there was no turning back. Almost right away, things started to break. The little wind-driven generator that powered their wireless radio failed. Gone. So now they had no way to talk to anyone, no way to get a position check, nothing. They were mute and deaf over the ocean. Then the weather closed in. You have to understand what the North Atlantic does to you. It is not a friendly stretch of air. Fog on the deck. Clouds stacked up for thousands of feet. Rain that turns to sleet and sleet that turns to snow, and all of it coming at you sideways in an open cockpit at 80, 90 miles an hour. Brown needed the sun and the stars to navigate, to shoot his sextant and figure out where they were, and for hours at a stretch, the sky gave him nothing but gray. Just gray above and below and all around, with no horizon at all. Think about that. Flying blind, in cloud, in a biplane with almost no instruments, no gyros to speak of, no artificial horizon like you and I take for granted. When you can't see the horizon and you can't feel which way is up, your inner ear starts lying to you. Every pilot listening knows exactly what I mean. That's the trap that kills people to this day. With all our modern gear, these two had a compass and a bubble in a tube and their own two hands. At one point in the night, deep in the cloud, they lost it. The Vimy stalled and fell off into a spin down through the black, spiraling toward an ocean they couldn't even see. Alcock had no horizon, no way to know up from down, just the wind changing its tune and the compass tumbling. They came spinning out of the bottom of the cloud, so low over the water that Brown said afterward, he could see the whitecaps and taste the salt spray. Alcock leveled her out with the sea, practically brushing the wheels, got the nose up and climbed away, that close. That is how close the whole thing came to ending in the middle of the ocean with nobody ever knowing why. And then it got worse, because it got cold. They climbed to get above the weather, and up high the sleet and snow started to freeze on the airplane. Ice built up on the wings, worse it built up on the little gauges mounted out on the engines, the ones that told them the Eagles were running right. If those iced over, they'd be flying two engines by feel and prayer. The story that comes down to us, and it's the one Brown himself told, is that Arthur Whitten Brown, the man with the bad leg, climbed up out of that open cockpit, out of his seat into a 100-mile-an-hour freezing slipstream, thousands of feet over the black Atlantic in the middle of the night, and reached out along the airplane to chip and clear the ice off those gauges with his hands. More than once, a man with a cane on the ground, out on a wing over the ocean, so the engines would keep singing. That's not in any checklist. That's just what the situation demanded, and there was nobody else to do it. They ate cold sandwiches. They had a thermos of coffee, some chocolate. A little whiskey, and I won't pretend otherwise, because a nip of whiskey in an open cockpit over the freezing Atlantic was medicine as much as anything. They took turns. Hour after hour, one man flying while the other fought to stay warm enough to think. And they carried, of all things, two little stuffed toy cats for luck, mascots. Two grown men, war veterans, crossing an ocean nobody had ever crossed. And they brought toy cats along. I love that. It tells you they were human. It tells you they were scared, and they knew it, and they went anyway. Somewhere in that long night, Brown got his window. A break in the cloud, a few stars, just long enough to shoot the sextant and fix their position. And his navigation, done with a pencil and a watch and the math in his head, in the cold, in the dark, turned out to be very nearly perfect. As the sun came up on June the 15th, they saw it, land. Two little islands off the coast and then the green coast of Ireland itself, right about where Brown said it would be, County Galway. They had crossed the entire Atlantic Ocean, nearly 1,900 miles of open water, non-stop, in about 16 hours. Now all they had to do was land. And here the Atlantic had one last joke to play. They came down near a town called Clifton, and from the air they spotted what looked like a lovely flat green field. Perfect. Alcock set up his approach, brought that big Vimy down gentle as you please, touched down on the beautiful green grass, and the wheels went straight in. It wasn't a field, it was a bog. A soft Irish peat bog, and to the airplane it might as well have been quicksand. The wheels dug in, the airplane pitched forward. And the Vimy stood up on her nose in the mud with her tail in the air, all that history bent and buried in the muck. Neither man was hurt, a bump on the nose maybe. They climbed down out of that broken airplane onto solid ground, the first men ever to fly the Atlantic nonstop, and the first fellows to reach them were soldiers from a nearby wireless station who could hardly believe what they were being told. Across the ocean, in that, overnight? They had done it, and they had carried a small sack of mail with them, which makes their little bog landing the very first transatlantic airmail delivery as well. Within days, King George V knighted both of them, Sir John Alcock, Sir Arthur Whitten Brown. They collected the Daily Mail prize, £10,000, and for a brief shining moment, they were the two most famous aviators alive. And here's the part that always gets me. The part I want you to sit with. John Alcock, that cheerful natural pilot who threaded a 6-ton bomber across an ocean and lived, was dead 6 months later. December of 1919. He was flying a new airplane to an air show in France, ran into fog, and went down in a field, just gone. The Atlantic couldn't kill him. A patch of fog on a routine flight did. Brown, the navigator, was so shaken by losing his friend that he more or less stopped flying. He lived on for many years, quiet, private, carrying that cane and that memory. He never really chased the spotlight again. And the wider world, well, the wider world did what it so often does. It forgot. 8 years later, Lindbergh flew alone to Paris, and it was a magnificent thing, and it swallowed up the memory of the two men who'd already crossed the ocean the hard way, side by side, in the dark, in an open cockpit, chipping ice off the engines with their bare hands. That's why we tell these stories in here. So the right names don't get lost in the fog. If you ever get to London, go find the Science Museum, because that very Vickers Vimy, the actual airplane that Alcock and Brown flew across the Atlantic, was pulled out of that Irish bog, cleaned up, repaired, and it hangs there to this day. You can stand under it. You can look up at that fabric and that wire and those two Rolls-Royce Eagles and think about a June night in 1919 and two men and two toy cats and an ocean that very nearly won. My thanks to the Science Museum in London and to the contemporary reports in the aviation press of 1919 for keeping the details of that flight alive for all of us. You can find more of what we do over at RadioHanger.com. So the next time somebody at the fly-in tells you Lindbergh was first across the Atlantic, you buy that fellow a coffee and you set him straight. Gently, then you tell him about the bog at Clifton. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep the blue side up.